Hey, everybody, and welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenue's Minor League Podcast. I'm Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos, Ken Laffin, and Thomas Henderson. How's everyone doing this week?
Good, good.
Doing all right. Mm-hmm. Would be nice if my running backs could stop getting hurt, you know, but here we are.
All right, so promote extend trade this week. And on this date in 1970, PBS started broadcasting. And I'm not really sure if it's the case anymore because cable is a lot more broad and common than it was like 20, 25 years ago. And then obviously the internet came along and changed everything. But PBS was definitely a big part of my youth. I'm sure you guys too.
Was Sesame Street a PBS thing?
Yes.
Okay, I watched some of that.
That was like the anchor show. I don't know if that's a term, but...
My parents didn't let me watch a lot of TV. I'd like watch Jeopardy, and that was about it.
Nice.
Jeopardy explains a lot, doesn't it?
Jeopardy would be like the adult equivalent of PBS broadcasting.
Yeah.
All right, so then of these shows, what will we promote, extend, or trade? And I think that these are all kind of common enough shows that, Lucas, you can fill in the gaps here.
Uh-huh.
First one is Arthur. Then we have Shining Time Station. And finally, we have Barney.
The hell is Shining Time Station?
Jesus Christ, man.
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, I'm not alone.
What is wrong with you people?
Well, Steve, I don't think we have a long enough podcast to answer that question.
Thomas
many,
the Tank
many,
Engine.
Many things.
Thomas yeah. the Tank Engine. We're we ringing go. Any bells.
Yes.
I know that.
Wait, that was the name of the show?
Yes.
Oh.
Oh,
I just called
okay.
it Thomas the Tank Engine. Then
it
I know
had
that.
Fucking Ringo Starr, our one podcast listener.
Our one listener is Ringo Starr, yes.
As he was
Confirmed.
He was the main character in Shining Time Station. And then George Carlin. Oh, my God. I'm
wild.
Just so...
I didn't know that that was the name of it. I would have never guessed.
I would never watch Thomas the Tank Engine show, period. And B, I wouldn't have known that name in 100 years. Anyway.
I'm just like, I'm about to just hang up on this podcast.
Oh, not good.
But for our one listener, Ringo Starr out there, I won't. So we will continue.
Uh-huh. I'm gonna go like hardcore internet reference here, and I'm gonna extend the Thomas the Tank Engine show because I love Thomas the Tank Engine memes.
Mm.
Like the Skyrim mod where you turn the trains, turn all the dragons into trains.
Yep.
Or the ones where they turn the whole town into like eldritch horrors. They're like actually monsters with multiple limbs living inside the train cars, you know? It's right up my alley. And I'm for sure trading Barney because that purple dinosaur is an annoying fuck and I hate him.
Mm-hmm. And you also have the Arthur memes.
The Arthur definitely gets extended.
Yeah, same.
You're extending Arthur? Okay.
I'm extending Shining Time Station.
Steve, it occurs to me now that your correct response would be, it was time for Steve to go. He had seen everything.
Oh, well.
What kind of name is that? Why not just call it the Thomas the Tank Engine show?
Because it was more than just the 5-minute Thomas the Tank Engine shorts. They built an entire show around it that took place at Shining Time Station.
See,
to stretch
like,
it out to, you know, a half an hour kid show.
I would have never in a trillion years have known that.
Were there, people?
Yeah.
There were?
I thought it was just Thomas for 30 minutes. No. Rolling around.
Well, I knew there were other trains and they had names, right?
Yes,
but I didn't realize,
right.
And then there's the fat conductor dude. But right. There are other people?
Yes, live actors. It was a whole thing. Like, I know I'm a little older than you guys, but still, like, I'm pretty sure that the show was on until, like, the mid to late 90s. Like, oh, man.
I mean, I have very strong, vivid memories of Thomas the Tank Engine, just not of the rest of the extended world.
It had the human cast. Obviously, like I said, there was Ringo Starr and George Carlin. It also had the girl, the lead girl from Grease with the squeaky voice. She was also in it. It had some pretty, like, big celebrities.
Would they play themselves?
No, they were characters. They worked at the aforementioned Shining Time Station, which was an old train station that was, like, haunted by Mr. Conductor, who, you know...
was fat Conductor Man?
No, he was Ringo Starr and or George Carlin in series 1 and 2. And he, you know, when the children that were there had problems, he would tell them a morality tale, and then that morality tale would be the Thomas the Tank Engine short.
Huh. You know, I'm thinking about it a little bit more. I don't think I watched PBS the channel. I watched a lot of, like, PBS VHS specials. So, like, mm-hmm. the dinosaur one, or maybe those were Eyewitness VHS specials. I don't remember, dude. My brain is mush. Point is, I never watched a show about people associated with Thomas the Tank Engine.
Well, I guess that's what happens when you watch too much Mets baseball. Your brain just becomes mush.
That's not fast enough, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately. All right, well, let's move on from this curse topic then. And we'll go to another curse topic, the CPBL, KBO, and MPB.
Yep.
And for the second straight week now, the Unilions went 2-3. So that puts them at 25-23-1 in the second half, which is a game behind the Fuban Guardians. And that gives them a magic number of 11 for elimination. The hit of the week is Anko Lin. He had a pretty damn good week. He went 10-20 with a double, 5 homers, 3 walks, and 9 RBI total. So that gives him 32 homers on the season now. So he needs just one more to tie the Lions single season record, which is 33. And that was set by Tilson Brito in 2007. And the CPBL home run record is 39. That was set by Kuo Hui Kwa in 2015. And there's 11 games left, so it's not completely out of reach for Lin to get
real,
there.
It'll be a real tear.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this past week he hit 5 homers, so he's on a hot streak, and he does have 5 multi-homer games for the year, so he might. It's pretty unlikely, but in theory, it's possible. And much less exciting is the pitcher of the week, and that goes out to our once former draft pick and our Eastern League friend, Teddy Stankiewicz, who pitched 6 scoreless innings, and he won his 4th game in Taiwan, scattering 3 hits. He walked 1, and he struck out 6. Next up are the LG Twins. They had their first bad week in a while. They went 3-5, so that leaves them at 67-55-3 in the year, which drops them down to 4th place now. Hitter of the week is Hyung Jung Lee. Lee was the hitter of the week a couple of weeks ago. He was the guy that was originally drafted as a pitcher, and he hit a ton of injuries to the point that he retired, and then he came back as a hitter, and he's been a pretty solid hitter since. He went 12-25 with 2 doubles, 4 homers, 3 walks, a hit by pitch, and 13 total RBI. And pitcher of the week is rookie Minho Lee, no relation to Hyung Jung, and he gave up 2 runs over 6 and a third innings, allowing 3 hits, walking 4, and striking out 7. And Lee was pitcher of the week really early on in the season. He was the Twins' regional draft selection last year, and he's having a relatively decent rookie year. He's a 4.15 ERA in 82 and a third innings, allowed 83 hits, walked 35, and struck out 58, which is a 3.7 and a 6. K per nine, walks per 9 and strikeouts per 9. And last up are the Swallows. And would you believe me if I said they went 6-0 this week?
No.
No. Nope.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm lying.
I believe you if you said they went 0-6.
Yeah. They went 2-4. So.
Oh, okay.
Not as big. Could have been worse. Mm. And they are 34-49-6, which is 21.5 games behind the Giants now. So the old veteran Tomotaka Sakaguchi, he is hitter of the week, and it wasn't a particularly impressive week, but, you know, slim pickings. And he went 6 for 20 with 2 doubles, 4 walks, and 3 total RBI. And surprisingly, we have a pretty solid pitching performance for Pitcher of the Week this week, and it's somebody new. Right-handed pitcher Hiroaki Sayauchi. And he pitched 7 scoreless innings, allowing 5 hits, walking 2, and striking out 4. So, Sayauchi, this is his first season with the Swallows. He was initially drafted by the Hanshin Tigers in 2011, and he played with them from 2012 until last season when he was released. Then he signed with the Weizhong Dragons, who are an expansion team that's going to be joining the CPBL next year. They haven't actually played any games yet, but they're allowed to, you know, sign players. And then he also signed with the, at the same time, the Kagawa Olive Gainers, which is a team in the Shikoku Island League, which is an independent league in Japan. And he put up decent numbers for them, and the Swallows picked him up because, as we know, their pitching really sucks. And so far, he's given up 7 earned runs in 14 and a third innings, which comes out to a full 40 ERA. And that's pretty much in line with his career numbers. He has a career 4.25 ERA. Very typical Japanese pitcher. His fastball tops at around 91 or so. It used to be a little higher. It used to top around 93, 94. But a couple of years ago, he hurt his shoulder, so he lost some of that velocity. And then he complements the fastball with a okay slider, an okay curve, and a pretty good splitter. So that is about as prototypical Japanese right-hander as you can get.
Just super average.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, we'll come back now to America, and we have a little bit of Mets roster player news, whatever you want to call it. First thing we'll talk about, I guess, is the draft. And last week, games are still going on as we were recording, so there were a lot of variables. But the Mets would have been able to pick as low as 7 and high as 12, and now the dust settled, and the Mets are going to be picking 10th overall.
Such a Mets spot.
It's better, you know. It ain't bad. A lot of, you know, another win or two, and they could have been, you know, like 16, 17, which is definitely a Mets thing.
Mm.
But, you know, yeah. 10 overall is pretty good. Interestingly,
yeah, that's about the bottom of where I'd be like, okay.
Yeah. Interestingly, there has not been a single Hall of Famer that's been drafted 10th overall, but there's been a lot of good, solid to elite players. Mark McGwire, who you could put an asterisk next to the Hall of Fame thing, because
he should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it is what it is. But yeah, McGwire, Robin Ventura, Ben Sheets, Madison Bumgarner, Tim Lincecum.
Ben Sheets, now that's a name I've not heard in a long, long time.
That's why I included that name, because I was like, wow, I remember Ben Sheets.
He was a free agent right around the time I was getting into roster planning and thinking about free agent moves. I really wanted the Mets to sign Ben Sheets as like a reclamation mm-hmm. project at some point.
Ben Sheets and Eric Bedard.
Yeah.
Yep.
They're like the same, but Sheets wasn't he right-handed and Bedard was left-handed, or were they both lefties?
I think they were both righties. I think Bedard was right.
Am I just off my rocker?
You might be. I mean, you don't know Shiny Time Station, so.
Oh, right. You got me there.
and on the Mets right now is Michael Conforto, who they picked at 10, so he's obviously.
Said there's no Hall of Famer, Steve.
Well,
ha! No, you're the one off your rocker. Ben Sheets is right-handed and Bedard is left-handed. Ha!
Last week when we were talking about going to the future, so I can't see to the future right now. So, and then looking past those kind of guys that have already had pretty good careers and established themselves, the number 10 pick in the last couple of years has been pretty good. Reed Detmers was picked in 2020. Hunter Bishop was 2019. Travis Swaggerty's 2018. And it's no doubt that Detmers and Bishop would be slam dunk the Mets' top prospect if they're in the system. And you could even make a case for Swaggerty over Mauricio. So regardless of the player the Mets draft, it will be somebody pretty good.
Yeah, there'll be someone that's right at the top of our lists.
Mm-hmm.
Unless
they've
like
historically done pretty well with top 10 picks.
Mm-hmm.
And Sandy should be back, so.
Hopefully.
Like, that's the expectation, I guess, right now.
Well, we'll see. Hopefully it's not Brody. Although Brody has drafted pretty well, so. But, yeah. And then some other 2021 news now. Some of the Mets' top prospects are going to be getting a little bit of organized experience over the winter, so they'll be less rusty going to the year next year, assuming that there is a year next year. Mm-hmm. So two prospects have been announced as playing in the winter leagues. One of them is Mark Vientos. He's going to be playing in the Dominican Winter League for Los Leones de Escogido. And Escogido is not actually a city. They play in Santo Domingo. Escogido means chosen. So the team is actually the Chosen Lions, which I think is pretty badass.
That's pretty sweet.
That's mm-hmm. fire.
And then the other prospect that they're going to be, that's going to be playing that we know about right now in the winter leagues is Francisco Alvarez. And he's going to be playing on the complete other side of the world with the Sydney Blue Sox, which is a team in the Australian Baseball League. And interestingly enough, the Blue Sox a couple of days ago, I think maybe a day or two before they announced that Alvarez was going to be playing with them, they posted like a teaser tweet with a picture of the Mets logo, and it had a time six next to it. So I'm assuming that in addition to Alvarez, the Mets are going to be sending five other prospects over to the Blue Sox with him.
Or Jeff McNeil.
Oh, yeah, I mean, somebody.
But imagine, what would his batting average be?
600.
Yeah, it would be really high.
You know how, like, Jeff McNeil always feels like he should get a hit and is, like, pissed off
should.
Every time?
Always
yeah, I know.
He should be mad if he gets out.
When was the last time... I can't remember a Met prospect or a prospect for any other team going to play in Australia, honestly.
They do all the time, but most of the time the guys that I don't really bother following because the winter leagues are just kind of like mishmash baseball in terms of what's going on.
It's just wherever you think you can get reps.
Yeah, exactly. So you'll have guys that, you know, are as low, you know, as far down as low A, playing with guys that are in triple A. It's kind of like, you know, the what's the word? The talent disparity is just all over the place, or the talent level. So
it's pretty fun, though. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things where it's not really that useful for getting information out of it as much as it's fun to watch. And then obviously the guy, you know, it's important that the guys get that little bit of extra playing time to just not be rusty.
Especially now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
We were literally saying the same thing, but yeah, like, especially this year, because he didn't play really. Like, who knows how the level of competition he faced at the,
mm-hmm.
whatever they were doing at the site, at the offsite.
And I think that it's great that they'll be getting a little extra playing time, but really, even more important to me with these guys going to the Blue Sox is the fact that they're going to get, as Ken pointed out, they're going to get to be teammates with Manny Ramirez.
So, have we confirmed that? Because he's not listed on their roster on Wikipedia that I'm looking
well,
at right now.
I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty sure, but who knows with Manny?
Manny being Manny.
Manny could be just being Manny. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't he like a player manager cool. in the Taiwanese Baseball League?
He was a player manager with the Iowa Cubs. In 2014, he was pretty well liked and everything like that. So honestly, I don't really care if the prospects that they send do good or bad. I hope that it's actually just a way to woo Manny to come and play for us, like Manny the third base coach or something.
I mean,
Manny the hitting coach. Like
he's going to be on the team because they have merch on their Twitter. They tweeted it.
Yep, there you go. Then
they have jerseys for sale and they have a hoodie. That's a blue sock.
I might have to get one.
Hold on. The hoodie is a blue sock, right? And it has dreads. And it has a bat.
Oh, that's hysterical, actually.
That's yeah. Manny.
And, like, they're going to... I mean, obviously, like, if I'm going to buy a Sydney Blue Sox stuff, it's going to be a Manny Ramirez thing. So,
oh, of course.
They're being smart, but...
But, I mean, you know, Mullins is probably, I guess, just based on his kind of... body of work and how much he's respected stay as hitting coach, but bring Manny in for some kind of, like I said, third base coach. Imagine the terrible calls that Manny will make at third base sending runners.
Oh my God, it'd be a disaster.
But it would be amazing and great at the same time.
This is the kind of thing you should do in a losing season, right? They should have done that this year.
Right.
When, who was the third base coach this year? DeSarcina, right?
I think so.
Yeah, and then he was like out with not COVID, but he probably had COVID for a couple weeks. Like, bring Manny in for it'll be fun.
Manny could just be the floating coach.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Covers whatever position is not available for that week.
What he should listed as coach on the website.
Yeah, exactly. No, no, he's not listed as coach. He's just listed as Manny. Manny Ramirez. Manny.
We're paying him to be Manny. Well, of course.
You mean like shortening? Are you shortening the word manager? No, no, we just mean Manny.
And of course, bringing Manny to the Mets would correct that, you know, historic injustice that he was never traded for or anything like that back in the early 2000s. So
that would have been so fun.
Mm-hmm.
I loved watching him. He was great.
Mm-hmm. But he made. I know I saw this rant from an LA fan years ago about how those seats down the left field line actually suck, but he made them like the most marketable in the ballpark. Manny would.
And like he couldn't play defense, and like I'm a weirdo with defense where like I really like it, but like I don't care. Put him in center field as long as he's on the
God.
Team.
Well, he'd be coaching. We don't need a center field coach.
I mean,
although
yeah,
actually,
Thomas, he's almost like 50.
Is Manny Ramirez that old?
Yeah,
he's in his late 40s. He might actually even be 50 at this point.
I think he's 48. I think I looked it up the other day. Yeah, 48.
I'm sure if Julio Franco could like stick around and get hits at like 50, I'm pretty sure if that role still existed in baseball, Manny could like hang out on a bench and collect hits occasionally.
Designated Manny.
Yeah, exactly.
The Mets should have him and Cano split DH and have the oldest per capita DH in the league.
they probably still could hit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Cano obviously can hit, and I would not bet against Manny.
No, no way.
All right, so in a statement, future Mets owner Steve Cohen gave last week, he said, quote, "If I'm fortunate enough to be approved by Major League Baseball as the next owner of this iconic franchise, Sandy Alderson will become president of the New York Mets and oversee all Mets baseball and business operations. I'm excited to have Sandy in a key leadership role with the Mets if my purchase of the team is approved. Let's go, Mets." Obviously, you know, Sandy is a name that we're all familiar with. He was GM for basically this past decade, give or take. And his, you know, vision for the Mets, given all of the constraints put upon him, obviously, with the Wilpons and all that going on, you know, shaped the Mets into the team that they are today. So, with that in mind, we're going to look over Sandy Alderson's 10 years Mets GM from when he was first hired to 2014. We'll look at some free agent signings from a minor league point of view. So I'm just kind of going to ignore the major league ones, the obvious, you know, signings, and just look to see how sometimes obscure minor league contracts would go on to have pretty big impact on the major league roster. We'll look at his draft picks and were any of them terrible? You know, was anything, any obvious guys that they should have picked? We'll look at his international free agent signings and, you know, were there any hits there, you know.
You're telling me we're not going to do a deep dive on the Frank Francisco signing 10 years later?
I was thinking about it, and then actually that's what made me say, you know what, I don't even want to deal with major league free agents. So we'll go to start with 2011. We'll start with free agent signings. And on January 25th, he signed free agent Tim Burdick to a minor league contract. And, Burdick became a perfectly solid reliever for basically 2 of the 3 years that he was on the team. So definitely found some gold there. On February 16th, 2011, he signed Jason Isringhausen to a minor league contract. And there's definitely a lot of ways to look at this one, and basically they're all positive. The Mets got a reliever that they relied on quite a bit over the course of that season. 2, Izzy was a mentor for Bobby Parnell, and Parnell became a better pitcher as a result. And then three, Isringhausen was, of course, part of Generation K. And the fact that he got a second life on his career because the Mets were willing to give him another shot is kind of, you know, poetic, because his first career with the Mets as a starting pitcher wasn't really all that great.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, when was the last time the Mets signed a minor league reliever and got something useful out of it?
Well, I mean, a couple of times the Mets hit on some people, but during the Alderson era. During the Brody era, I don't really know. Which says something, I guess.
Yeah.
It's part of the problem, because there's just so many arms you need now that you need to do stuff like this.
Yep. Those are really the only minor league free agents that had an impact, really, in 2011. So we'll go over to trades now, and there were a couple. One is his first trade, and this one was a doozy, of course. On December 27th, 2010, his first trade, he traded left-hander Michael Antonetti to the Dodgers in exchange for Chin Lung Hu. And then had that press conference.
Is it bad that I have literally zero memory of either of these players?
You don't remember who at all?
No.
Like, they literally had a press conference. He was like a Ruben Tejada, Omar Quintanilla type of shortstop. Probably worse than that. And they had, like, a legit press conference introducing him and everything.
I remember that was
the first trade that Alderson made, so it was, like, all pomp and circumstance fanfare. And he was just a jabroni, basically.
Nothing? Maybe my brain actually is mushy.
Well, yeah, I mean, really the only reason why that trade is notable is because of that press conference and just how ridiculous it was. But interestingly enough, both Antonini and Hu are both playing. Antonini has been playing in the Atlantic League since 2013, and who's been on the Fubon Guardians in the CPBL, so they're both going strong. Maybe this is a trade that you'll remember. On July 13th, the Mets traded Francisco Rodriguez to the Brewers in exchange for minor league reliever Adrian Rosario and Quad A reliever Danny Ray Herrera, and then some cash.
The shortest dude ever.
Yep. That's why I was a fan of him, because he threw a screwball, and he was like the shortest pitcher in baseball history. So how could you not root for a guy like that?
Much easier to root for him than Francisco Rodriguez, to be sure.
Mm-hmm. It sucks that the Mets really got trash for K-Rod, given that, you know, all of the off-the-field stuff and the Madoff stuff with the Mets, and his numbers were still, like, okay, but, I mean, they got nothing for a guy who was a competent reliever, and he'd still pitch decently for another couple of years, but
I mean, he was like bonkers with the Angels, came to the Mets and sucked. Didn't suck. He was
decent, okay.
But
yeah,
there was like just it didn't matter. They gave up the pick that became, in quotations, Mike Trout, even though it was actually Randall Grichuk, but you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then went on to have like another 6-7 good years.
And I would say, when would you say like the peak reliever trade market was, like 2015, 16, 17 in there?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Like, imagine if the Mets had Rodriguez at that point and traded him during that period. Like, they could have gotten a lot more than two nobodies, basically. But one trade that took place a couple of, like, 2 weeks later after that definitely netted the Mets to somebody. And on July 28th, 2011, the Mets traded Carlos Beltran to the San Francisco Giants in exchange for Zach Wheeler. And that was
that worked.
Big get. Yeah.
It's pretty wild how they got someone as good someone as high profile as Wheeler for a rental.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, back then, that could still happen.
Like, Carlos Beltran is Carlos Beltran.
He was still hitting until that point 289, 391, 513 with 15 homers.
One of the best players in the league, so I get it. But, like, it's pretty, like, now someone trading a prospect that good for a rental would be, like,
insane.
Yeah.
No one would even, you wouldn't even come close to someone that could.
Who was the outfielder that we all thought they were actually getting? Brown or something like that. I don't remember.
Gary Brown, yeah.
Gary Brown.
Center fielder dude who couldn't hit and then never hit. And we all were like, I remember the initial speculation right after the news was announced was that, oh, it's going to be for this dude because he was their number two prospect. And they was like, okay, like objectively, that's fine, but not very exciting. And then it was Wheeler. It's like, oh, great.
Yeah, I mean, Gary Brown did not have a career, noteworthy career. And, you know, Wheeler missed some time because of Tommy John and the complications, but he ended up pitching 749 and one-third innings for the Mets over 5 years, had a 377 ERA, 100, exactly 100 ERA plus. So, I mean, he became a guy that the Mets kind of relied on, but, you know, couldn't at the same time, but definitely won that one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll look over at the draft now, the 2011 draft, and the Mets had two first round picks. First was Brandon Nimmo, who was selected 11th overall, and the second was Michael Fulmer, who was selected 44th overall. Can't complain about Nimmo, really.
No.
No, I mean, a lot
at this point, he's a well above average hitter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dude's an incredible hitter. Has like elite level plate discipline. Ah, yes, the sounds of New York City in the background. one of us is being taken away. I remember for a couple years after the fact, there was like bitching and moaning about Jose Fernandez being selected after Nimmo, and it's like, come on, dude! Like, there's no one knew that was going to happen.
No,
it's also like with the baseball drafts and stuff. As long as you get someone good, I almost don't care who was around. Like. Right. It's so random.
It's all so random.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's in different sports, like, oh, you passed on this quarterback for this one. You lost that. Like, yeah. But in baseball, Nimmo is a good hitter, and, like, he could play the corner outfield pretty well. I don't think he could play center. But even so, you put him in left, and he's one of the better left fielders.
He's like a solid 3-5 win player.
Exactly.
You know,
he's very
growing. Those are the guys you need on a team with – say championship aspirations, you know, that's what those teams are built out of.
Yeah.
You know,
you need to draft those guys because when you pay for them, you probably have to pay a little more than you want. And
he has a skill set that I in particular really, really love. Like, I just love the extreme plate discipline guys. It's too bad that Joey Votto can't hit for power anymore. Cause that's what he was. Nimmo is very much in that vein of player.
Mm-hmm. And then other guys that were selected during that draft was Rob Gesellman in the 13th round, Phil Evans in the 15th round, John Gant in the 21st round, and Seth Lugo in the 34th round. So
that's
not
a bad, real good draft.
Not a bad
hole.
We didn't even talk about Fulmer there.
No.
And who was like before he got hurt was good.
Right, and then we got a Cespedes.
Mm-hmm.
And I will still die on the hill that Fulmer was an overpay because there's no way you know that Cespedes is going to turn into fucking Babe Ruth on atomic-powered steroids for a month and a half. But
we'll get to that.
It's an overpay I'm okay with, but yeah.
We'll, absolutely.
Sometimes you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, no, I understand that. The Tigers definitely waited too long to trade Fulmer because he's always hurt. Getting a usable major league arm in Gesellman and a potential like a borderline great reliever in Lugo. That's all. Even Gant has been a very good.
Yeah, Gant is good.
A couple of years. Yeah.
Phil Evans somehow was good this year before he hurt himself.
He's with the Pirates, right?
Yeah.
I didn't get why the Mets gave up on. I mean, they have a lot of infield depth now, but when they gave up on him, it was like we have no infield depth. Why are you getting rid of this dude?
Did he keep getting hurt? I don't remember.
Yeah, he got like a couple like little things. It wasn't like anything drastic, but it was just very Metsy and give up, it felt like.
Oh, yeah.
And then looking at the IFA market, they had a couple of high price signings that year. One, Vicente Lupo, who they signed for $350,000. Then there is third baseman Pedro Perez, they signed for $280,000. Luis Mateo, they signed for $150,000. And the most successful of the bunch, and also the cheapest, is Rafael Montero that they signed for $80,000. Huh. Definitely a good find there with Montero. Another guy that the Mets gave up on a little too early, it seems.
Yeah, I can't.
So that's one of those where I know why they gave up.
Oh, yeah, no, it's not like, why did you do that, you stupid idiots? It's a situation where it just, you know.
You get to a point where, like, especially with the draft, like we were talking about a few minutes ago, like, so much development happens, you know, beyond – the organization has such an influence on the development of the player. Like, at some point, he's just not going to figure it out in a, you know.
Yeah, well, there's a player who –
you know.
We'll talk about a player like that in a couple of minutes here in a future year that is 100% the case. He would not have become the solid player that he did become in this organization. He needed a change of scenery.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on Montero. He was one of those dudes that signed older than most. He was like 20, so they got him.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a good find because I feel like a lot of those guys probably slipped through the cracks. So,
yep.
Get it? I mean, even getting like a quad A type arm out of a DSL signing is good.
Yeah, I mean, any guy that gets a fairly up the minor league ladder out of the Dominican and up into the, you know, maybe past high A, you're like, okay, that was a pretty good signing, even if they don't actually make it because they came so close. All right, now we'll move on to 2012. So looking now at free agent signings, the first one of note came in December 2011, and Mets, not exactly a free agent signing, but the Mets claimed Jeremy Hefner off of waivers from the Pittsburgh Pirates. And Hefner was a pretty cromulent fifth starter for a couple of years. And I guess more importantly than that, you know, he established a rapport between himself and the team because he's their chosen pitching coach now, so... That worked out for him.
Yeah, no, I remember liking Hefner until his elbow. He had Tommy John, and then his elbow like literally exploded while rehabbing, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Yes.
But he was solid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was slightly below average, which is completely fine for your back end starter, especially for the the early 2000s. I mean, the early 2010 Mets.
Oh God.
Yeah, the pitching was not a strength there, so.
Neither was the hitting.
No
strengths.
There was no strengths, exactly. A few days later, the Mets made another important minor league free agent signing. They signed left fielder Mike Baxter. And, you know, he was a pretty decent fourth outfielder / pinch hitter for the next couple of years. But obviously, the most important thing about Baxter is that he was in left field in the seventh inning on June 1st, 2012, and he made that catch against Yadier fucking Molina. Because you know, if it was anybody else, Molina would have burned us again. But Mike Baxter's...
It's always Yadier Molina.
Mm-hmm. But Mike Baxter is from Whitestone, he's a Mets fan, and all that kind of stuff, so fate canceled fate. And it worked out, finally.
I looked up Baxter's like Fangraphs page a little bit ago, I don't remember why. But he was a lot better than I realized.
Yeah, like, a really, I mean, I don't want to say really good hitter. He's like a nice on-base percentage guy.
Like, I thought he was like some rando who was there because the Mets were awful. Mm-hmm. But like, he was kind of like a solid fourth outfielder before he got hurt. Like you could see him having a career. Like,
he's a good situational kind of guy to have on your team.
Absolutely.
Kind of the Alderson model.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Walks a lot.
No, it never really got back after that shoulder injury, though, and injuries are tough.
In 2011, he had a 124 weighted runs created plus, and in 2012, he had a 115. Like, what?
Yeah, not bad.
That's, I mean, 2012 was a reasonable sample size,
yeah,
too, right? Like, he was playing
games,
a 89. Bunch.
Yeah. He played 89 games and had a 115 weighted. Like, as your fourth guy? Hell yeah.
It's what you like to see. Another signing took place on March 25th, and Chris Young was signed to a minor league contract, and weirdly, Chris Young ended up throwing the third most innings on the team that year behind Ari Dickey, Jonathan Neese, and he was actually, you know, pretty average.
Right?
He was all right. And, you know, like we said, with a couple of other guys, getting a league average hitter or pitcher for, you know, from a guy that's just basically an afterthought minor league signing, it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. It probably doesn't bode well for a healthier team because you're relying on a guy like that. But that aside, you know, good results.
He's one of those unsung heroes of a rebuild guy.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, the team is in bad shape and you just need a bunch of innings. And you get a guy basically for free to do that. That's good GMing when you're in that situation.
Yep, exactly. And so those are the only noteworthy minor league signings. And they had one noteworthy trade that took place in December 7th. And the Mets traded Angel Pagan to the San Francisco Giants in exchange for reliever Ramon Ramirez and center fielder Andres Torres.
I hated this deal. Oh. I hated it when it was made. I was like, what? They were so clearly still rebuilding, and you traded one dude who should be like a piece you sell for two other dudes who are worse pieces to sell.
It was a kind of, you know, two pieces to make up for that one.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
Pagan was an okay defender, an above average bat, and then Torres was an above average defender and with the bat. And then it was like, okay, Ramon Ramirez will make up the difference. And he really didn't.
I mean, it's the kind of move you make if you think you're going to contend and you have a hole in the bullpen and enough offense to weather the loss. Like, it's like, okay, this is a need for need. That's not what the Mets were.
No.
It made zero sense.
And, of course, Torres was coming off of a career year with the bat. And he wasn't really good with the Mets. And then Ramon Ramirez had a pretty solid resume over the last, you know, the prior couple of years. And of course, he wasn't really good with the Mets. So
Nope. The
one good thing, I guess, is it's not like there was any lasting damage or anything like that. You know, nope. Angel Pagan was a solid player to have, but losing him was not going to destroy anything.
It's more who you lost them for rather than the player.
It's funny. I was at a BP Mets event, probably like 2016 or so, and Alderson was asked about this, and he basically said, like, it was off the field reasons that we traded Angel Pagan.
Oh, jeez.
So read into that what you will.
Oh, well.
At that All point, right. Let's
look at the draft now, and in 2012, the Mets had the 12th selection overall, and they went with Gavin Cecchini.
I will always be mad about this.
Yeah, I mean, really, the jury comes down. It comes down to Lucas Giolito was sitting there, and there were all the questions surrounding him needing Tommy John surgery, and he dropped from being like top five into the teens, and Cheech was the safe guy. Giolito was the risk, and they got scared off by the risk. And in retrospect, I was totally wrong. Because Cheech didn't develop at all, and Giolito became Giolito, so.
Even then, it's just like, that type of pick is just so low ceiling that, like, it's just always going to make me a little mad.
There's like a fundamental disconnect. It's the same thing I always start ranting about with Anthony Kay and David Peterson, right? If you're going to take a low upside dude, which is what Gavin Cecchini was, they need to be a fast to the majors person. He's a high school shortstop. He's not going to be fast to the majors. So what are you doing? You're wasting time on a dude without upside.
Yep, that basically exposes the main kind of flaw in the rationale of, okay, Cheech was the safe one. They're both high school players.
Right. There's
an extreme risk no matter what.
There has never been a safe high school player.
Right. Oh, yeah. Don't draft low upside high school players in the first round. Or ever. But especially not in the first round.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You gotta swing if you're gonna do that.
I can understand, I don't agree with them, but I understand draft philosophies where you want a safe dude. Like, okay, take a college one.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think I'm more fine with that if you're going to spend money at the big league level.
Sure.
Because then you could fill in the bench pieces and the other things with the safe.
Yeah, absolutely. If you believe, like, contention is cyclic and you need a piece for you need that, like, fill-in piece for a year and a half or 2 years from now, fine.
Yeah, it makes more sense. But that was also a thing, a pick that even as soon as it was made, it was like, why? Like,
it
was just
not inspire anyone.
Yeah, it was just one of those where you're like, at least with Nemo, like, Nemo had the risk, like, we're past Nemo at this point, but, like, Nemo had the risk of the he didn't have the high school ball because of where he was from, but, like, you could see the upside and he hit it. So, like, you want to take that, you want to be a little uneasy, sure, but it's just uneasy and then it's unexciting if it even hits. Like, what is he even, if he reaches his best?
If you're going to take a prep shortstop early, you have to be positive he can either hit or play,
shortstop.
An adequate shortstop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For what it's worth, Cheech could do neither.
That's why you take that player. Like,
all of like the reports at the time said that he was a no doubt shortstop, uh-huh. And obviously, yeah, that didn't come to pass.
Well, that's another good point here. In that, not only is there the standard risk for high school to major league development, right? But athleticism and defense decline as you age.
Yeah.
If you're drafting someone as a sure shortstop, I kind of, again, want them to be closer to the majors, not someone who's going to need 8 years to develop and pick up nagging injuries and be 25 by the time they get here.
And really, at no point in time in all the different stops that I've saw him, either in person or, you know, online and watching videos, did he look like a shortstop? So I don't know what people saw, the scouts that were saying that, but I don't know.
It's probably, the funniest thing about Cheech to me was that everybody cited like his brother being a minor leaguer as like pedigree.
Mm-hmm. And his brother wasn't good either.
They were basically the same player and neither had a meaningful big league career.
Yep.
Garen
had a meaningful career, I guess.
He like did some things, did more than Gavin. That's true.
He had like one cup of coffee in the majors, I think, where he was like very, very solid, and then came back and was just terrible.
Wasn't his dad like a coach at LSU or something like that?
Something like that.
It was like baseball pedigree.
Yeah,
they knows like how to play the game.
Not exactly.
So does everyone else who gets drafted. Because, like, literally every person in the draft knows how to play the game.
I remember what you said, Thomas, or was I've already forgotten 5 minutes ago. Whoever went to Giolito, I remember that being the guy people were pointing to. Were there people talking about Corey Seager at the time? Because there's another high school shortstop taking six picks later, but who had the obvious...
He's like the complete flip side of Chichin.
Right. Yeah. He's what
or
you
like,
want
he's all upside, yeah. And
high school prospect.
And actual
to be honest,
pedigree.
Though, does Seager like do reach his heights in the Mets organization? You know, like
I mean, we could do that knows. With all of these guys. Yeah.
Yeah, true.
That's also another thing though, looking at Giolito. He's become such a good pitcher with the White Sox. Imagine the Mets have a very good reputation of developing good pitchers. Imagine what he could have been. With Mets brass, if he was a Met.
Because he was not good in Washington. Like
No.
When he came up, it was like, oh, he just might be bad.
And I mean, in Washington, it was just, hey, you have a 100-mile-an-hour fastball or whatever. Just keep throwing that, and it'll all work out.
Yeah.
Then he lost a little bit, and suddenly it didn't work out so well, and they had to fix him in Chicago, which, admittedly, they did a fantastic job of.
Oh, yeah, he's an ace now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Star.
I almost threw a perfect. Oh, excuse me. I almost threw a no hitter with him with his card in MLB like 2 weeks ago.
Nice.
So
he does good pitching ninja interviews too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, he's cool.
It was a pretty good draft all overall that year. Other guys that they had were Kevin Plawecki in the supplemental round, Matt Koch in the third round, Corey Oswalt, seventh round, Tomas Nito in the eighth round, Paul Sewald in the 10th round, Rob Whalen in the 12th round. Matt Bowman in the 13th round. Chris Flexen in the 14th round.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Tim Peterson in the 20th round. So
wow.
Yeah.
Even like Tim Peterson in the 20th round is like not a terrible pick.
No, that's a fantastic pick. And when you consider
it's kind of like the draft though where the famous line, we draft like a higher percentage of big leaguers than anyone, but like all of them are like replacement
bad.
Level dudes.
Yeah.
This is the draft that always makes me think of that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Like, you got a lot of big leaguers, but, like, one of them has been worth more than, like, a win.
See, that's career. That's actually a really fair point, Ken, because that, I think, gets right back to the Cicchini, the Cheech problem. Right? They've just taken all these unexciting, low upside guys, and yeah, they all make it to the majors, but do nothing. Like, they basically drafted an entire major league bullpen there, and it'd be the worst bullpen in baseball.
That's the truth. At least they did get to the major leagues, though, and the IFAs that they picked that year, nobody did. Nobody really even sniffed it. The highest paid guy that they signed that year was catcher Jose Garcia for $800,000. Then they had third baseman Johan Urania for $425,000.
I still think he would have been good.
Yeah, I remember him. Yeah.
And then right-hander Marcos Molina for $100,000.
Rip.
Yep. So that is 2012, and now we'll move on to 2013. And before we look at free agent signings, let's look at free agent signings that benefited the team that didn't actually happen, and not signing Michael Bourne that winter was a big...
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember this.
I was so mad that they did, like, furious that they passed on him.
Yep.
So mad. And then, like, a year later, I was like, oh.
The Mets came pretty close to giving him a contract that was very similar to the one that the Cleveland Indians gave him, but obviously Cleveland beat the Mets out. And a big reason why the Mets were hesitant to really pursue him that hard was because they weren't really – A, he wasn't really that great of a player. He was, like, you know, a solid player, but nothing fantastic. But more important than that, I guess, was the fact that draft protection for their first-round pick was in question. There was some confusion over whether or not the Mets pick was going to be protected. The Mets had the 10th worst record in baseball in 2011, so they had the 11th overall pick in 2013. But because the Pirates got a compensation pick with the 9th overall selection because they didn't sign Mark Appel the prior year, there was confusion. The actual text in the CBA states that the first 10 picks get protected, not the first 10
not
picks.
The 10 lowest records.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So, you know, obviously Cleveland signed him, so we'll never know how Major League Baseball was going to clarify the situation. But worst case scenario, the Mets signed Michael Bourne. He is not really that great, and they would lose out on their first round pick in 2013, a guy that, you know, we'll talk about in a little bit. But I honestly don't remember if I was pro or against, so.
Oh, I was pro. I was pro him, and I was pro Stephen Drew. So that's where.
Stephen Drew.
Stephen Drew, I want.
Wow.
That's where 2013 and 2014 Thomas was at. Just mad online that they did not sign these two individuals.
And look how far you've come. Now you're mad on a podcast online.
Yeah, right?
But Michael, like, Bourne is interesting to me because, like, he kind of soured me on free agent center fielders. Like, permanently. Like, I've never thought that was a good idea since how we dodged a bullet.
Argument for me when Thomas and I finally sit down to type this thing out.
Because I would like sign George Springer. And
Springer's not really of the same mold as the guys I'm talking about.
Are you sure? Springer's just a little bit better than Michael Bourne.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, the guy who's a center fielder, but, like, not really a center fielder. A guy whose only thing is speed. And, like, as soon as that goes away, he's screwed.
Yep. Yeah, but I was going to say that
Springer
that soured me. That soured me on the signing speed guys thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, that was – because Bourne was, like, he made his living off that. Like, that was the defense, and that was, like, a lot of the offense was being fast and working from there. And, like, I'd love players like that. Like, give me all the players like that, but the issue is when they're 30, they're not as fast anymore. Like,
Bourne, I think, was 29 or 28.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Yeah. He was getting there. So once that goes, it's gone. It doesn't come back.
Yep. All right, so now we'll look at the signings they actually did make. And on November 15th, 2012, they signed Carlos Torres to a minor league deal. And he'd become a pretty big part of the bullpen over the next couple of years. And he was a lot better than I remember him when I looked up his numbers.
Yeah.
And probably the craziest thing is that in 2014, the next year, he appeared in 73 games and pitched 97 innings. So your reliever is approaching 100 innings. Only the Mets.
also made one of the greatest plays you'll ever see at first base. Well, it was him and Murph making that play at first base in that game in Philly, where Jeff Francoeur hits a hard ground ball off of Carlos Torres's heel. Daniel Murphy careens to Daniel Murphy at first base, who like backhand flips it to Torres, who somehow beats Francoeur to the bag. Just an insane play.
The next and really only other interesting minor league signing they made that year was on January 31st, and they signed LaTroy Hawkins to a minor league contract. And Hawkins had a pretty good year, pretty good career, but he was winding down by the time the Mets signed him, and he had an incredible resurgence. He posted the highest F-WAR that he had ever had in the prior 9 years at the age of 40. So,
jeez.
Yeah. And then he was, you know, a pretty positive influence on rookie Jerry's Familia, and that would pay some dividends when, you know, Familia kind of established himself. And that quick pitch move that Familia periodically does came from Hawkins. So
I'm surprised the whole Hawkins bullpen was quick pitching, weren't they? For a couple of years because of Hawkins. Yeah.
I'm surprised that he's not like a pitching coach somewhere, because he seems to be a guy that knows pitching pretty well and is like universally liked. So, but I guess just, you know, there's only 30 pitching coach jobs and probably a lot of guys out there. All right, so those are all of the free agent moves. Now we'll move on to trades. And the first trade that took place in 2013 happened in December of 2012. And it was a big one. And Josh Tolley, Mike Nickias, and Ari Dickey were sent to Toronto Blue Jays in exchange for John Buck, Noah Syndergaard, Travis d'Arnaud, and Wilmer Becerra.
Ah, yes, and the famous Mike Nickias trade. Yes.
Yes. The rational part of my brain was like, wow, we just got two legit top 100 prospects, two top 50 prospects, John Buck, who's a solid major leaguer, and then a wild card, and Wilmer Becerra. But then the non-rational part of my brain was just like, wow, the Mets traded R.A. Dickey. So oh, I still kind of have, you know, it's still kind of a sore spot for me, but you can't
argue.
Steve,
if you love something, you have to let it go.
True. True.
Not to Canada, though.
Yeah, true.
He was, like, never even good for the Blue Jays, honestly.
He was, he became more of, like, a kind of durable innings eater guy.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't bad, but he wasn't the R.A. Dickey of old, either.
No. Look, the Mets sold high. They got a great return. Mm-hmm. I love R.A. Dickey. I love knuckleballers, but it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, you can't argue getting back Syndergaard, d'Arnaud, and Becerra, even though he didn't, you know, really work out. But
yeah, you never came back from that shoulder injury. This is never the same afterwards. The power never came back.
Nope.
Yeah, but he was one of those dudes that even as, like, a bottom level piece on that deal was like, oh, he could be interesting too. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
He's the kind of guy that the Mets are just giving away for free in all of their trades.
True.
Nowadays.
Yep.
Another trade. There was a lot of trades in 2013. The next one was on June 18th, and the Mets traded right-hander Colin McHugh in exchange for left fielder Eric Young Jr. And here's the guy that I was alluding to before about the analytics and needing a new place to kind of reinvent yourself. Because in the Mets, you know, McHugh was just kind of okay, you know, his stuff is just so-so across the board. But obviously then when he went to the Astros the next year and he was working with their analytics guys and, you know, cheating a little bit too, whatever. But he became, you know, a legitimate major league pitcher for a while there.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't have happened with the Mets.
See, it's funny you say that because it feels like when he was good, he had a very Metsy, Worthian pitching style mix, whatever you want to call it, right? So I always found it funny that they could never get things to work things out with him.
It just goes to show that sometimes all you need is just one guy to teach you something a different way, or show you something new or whatever, and that can completely change everything.
Mm-hmm.
And now the final trade that took place that year was on August 27th, and the Mets traded John Buck and Marlon Byrd in exchange for Dilson Herrera and Vic Black. And, you know, even though neither Black or Dilson worked out, it's still, you know, a win in terms of process, because Dilson Herrera was a legit prospect in the Pirate system, and Vic Black was, you know, interesting. And for two guys that had no future on the Mets whatsoever and didn't factor into any of their plans, they got back two guys that legit could have if they, you know, did work out.
Yeah, and that was just...
Black hurt himself, so...
100
you know,
times over 100.
Somehow Dilson is only 26, so maybe he still legit has time to become a legit player somewhere.
Can someone explain to me why Dilson hasn't gotten a shot somewhere? Like, he's hit for three different... He's, like, raked for three different organizations in AAA at this point. You're telling me that some shit team at the bottom of the league won't give this dude a chance to start?
I don't know. I think it's just he's kind of limited to, like, second, really, and he's okay defender, and he's short. I don't know. I don't know what to say.
I don't get it. Like, if the Mets are rich in infielders at the moment, and especially in second basemen, so there's no place for him here, but I feel like a smart rebuilding team would look at this guy and say, like, well, the only time he was in the majors and got an extended chance with a healthy shoulder, he was basically league average. Since then, he's come back from a serious shoulder injury, clearly has nothing left to show in AAA. Like, give Pickles a chance, please.
Please, someone.
Who are the Tigers running out there at second base now?
I think Scope was pretty good last year.
All right, yeah, they had Scope. Good point.
He was on Baltimore last year, right? Like, he was, like, playing first base and stuff?
He has all of 6 plate appearances for Baltimore last year.
Because I know he played against the Mets. Like, I remember. But I didn't know if he was, like, a regular part of their, like, up-and-down stuff, or he just was there for that game or that series.
We mentioned him before, Phil Evans with the Pirates. Like, Phil Evans could have just as easily have been Dilson Herrera.
Yeah.
You know, you just need someone to give you a shot, I guess, and I don't know. All right, looking at the 2013 draft now, the Mets had the 11th overall pick, and they went with Dominic Smith. And I don't want to use the B word because it wouldn't be appropriate completely, but for a while it was looking like the Mets really weren't going to get their money's worth from Smith. You know, he was never like a super power first baseman or anything like that, but even the power that he was showing wasn't really what you would have wanted. And then the bat was starting to look slow, and you could start to, you know, the B might start forming on your lips. But then he finally cracked the major league roster. He got that improved medical. He got his sleep apnea treated. He got into better physical shape. And now look at him. Who would have thunk?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've got to admit, I was very wrong on this one. I was very anti Dom Smith. I really wanted Reese McGuire. That didn't work.
Yeah, prep catchers, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, there's only two real players that have produced more value than Dom that would have been picked in that area. One is Hunter Renfroe, and then the other is Tim Anderson. And
oh, I'd take Tim Anderson right now.
Oh, yeah. But
I think I would take Dom over Renfroe, I think.
Yeah, definitely would.
But yeah. if this Dom is the real Dom, then it doesn't matter if those guys have good careers, because the guy the Mets picked is going to be a good player, too. So
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, at this point, like, Dom has looked, he looks good. Like, it's not only like he's hitting well and stuff, like he looks the part too to hit.
Yeah.
And if we keep the DH around as in the NL, then he'll have a spot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little nervous about what happens with him as his Mets future if the DH goes away, because I don't know, you got peed and
yeah.
I don't know if he can play in the field, and but that's another conversation. But
and it unfortunately it's probably not going away, so it is what it is at this point.
I mean, I like the DH, so it could say.
Well, you Same. Also didn't know Shining Time Station at both of you, so.
Well, that's...
I used to be anti-DH, then the Mets had too many position players, and now I'm very pro-DH.
That's how I feel, but I just won't accept it. It's like cognitive dissonance. I just won't.
I just don't miss the pitchers hitting. Like
I just want there to be an exception in the rule book for Zach Greinke. So Zach Greinke, no, but he's on the Astros anyway now. Shit.
Yeah, he was in the American League anyway. So.
I want Zach Greinke to be allowed to do whatever he wants on a baseball field forever until he retires.
I think that could be written to the next CBA.
Yeah.
I mean, if there is a legitimate two-way player, like a guy who could really hit, you could probably just not use the DH that game.
Yeah, that is true. According to the rules, you don't have to use the DH. You can have your pitcher pitch. I mean, your pitcher
You can
hit,
have him hit and then just have a regular thing that game where you pinch it for the relievers. Because... Mm-hmm. You'll have enough bench pieces, I'm sure. Like, it's not like teams are going to be running three-man benches with DH. They didn't do it this year, and American League teams don't do it either. So, you would conceivably have enough. And if the pitcher could hit for himself, even if you're going to take out the pitcher, you could still have them hit and then take them out after.
Right.
Yep.
But that's, like, big brain we're talking about. Like, a Shohei is pitching that game.
This is a little too complicated for Manfred to figure out, you know?
Galaxy Brain AL Manager.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, and then looking at the IFA market that year, really was not much. The only notable guy that they signed was Amed Rosario, who they signed for $1.7 million.
I mean, you'll take that.
Yeah, yep. I mean, he worked, regardless of where he goes from here, he's established himself to some degree at the major league level, so he has worked out. And
he makes it further than most.
IFA. That is exactly true.
If you could get even, like, a year's production out of an IFA dude, like Juan Lagares and stuff like that, you take that a million times over.
Yep. All right, we'll move on to 2014 now. And they really did not have any interesting – they didn't have any major minor league signings. Closest thing they had was re-signing Daisuke, who they signed in 2013.
Daisuke!
Yeah, he was, like – decent for the Mets in 2014, so it's just Daisuke, I guess. They did have some trades, though, one noteworthy one. On April 18th, near the beginning of the season, they traded first baseman Ike Davis to the Pittsburgh Pirates for Zach Thornton and a player to be named later who would become Blake Taylor. And Thornton, you know, did not work out. Blake Taylor, on the other hand, has become a very fine reliever for the not Mets. And if there's one thing the Mets could use, it is relievers.
Yeah. Taylor would have been, Diaz put himself back together. So once Lugo was out of the bullpen, Taylor probably would have been like the second best arm out there for the Mets this year.
And is Jake Marisnik, who they traded Blake Taylor for, is Marisnik, is he under contract for next year? Or?
Nope.
So they traded away, not that anybody could have foreseen Marisnik getting hurt, but so they traded away Blake Taylor, a solid reliever for like six games of Jake Marisnik.
Basically, yes.
Well, that's Mets in a nutshell, I guess.
I mean, it was a stupid trade in the first place, and then it worked out in about the worst way possible.
Yep. All right, now we'll go over to the draft, because that was the only noteworthy trade. And they had the 10th overall pick, and with it, they picked Michael Conforto. And basically, since the draft ended, Michael Conforto and Trey Turner have basically gone back and forth over which guy has been the better player in terms of career accumulated WAR. And I hope they keep going because it's, you know, they're both good players. Great players, really.
Yeah. I have to admit a mistake again here because I really wanted Bradley Zimmer.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I was like, hey, center field and center fielder who can hit. Oh, he can't actually hit.
I was on the Tukey Toussaint trade, and I still stand
by
that.
Oh, we know, Steve.
Know you love you some Tukey.
But, you know, you can't argue against Conforto.
No,
Definitely has developed into the best hitter the Mets have had since, like, the David Wright, Jose Reyes era.
I think he's the best player we've mentioned. so far.
Unless I'm Basically, it's a good thing that the Mets picked Conforto too, because that was not a particularly good draft for them. All those guys that they...
Go ahead.
All those guys that they had selected, like, the last prior two drafts that went on to work out, basically the only guy that the Mets picked that has logged major league innings was Brad Week, and Week wasn't even good in his handful of major league innings that he's accumulated so far.
You really missed an opportunity to say it was Week.
Oh, yeah,
very disappointed in you, Steve.
I'm sorry. I'm disappointed in that draft.
Yeah.
And also, speaking of not really disappointments, but the IFA class that year was mixed. The highest signing that they made that year was outfielder Ricardo Cespedes, who they signed for $725,000. Did not work out. The next highest guy, though, future still uncertain, is catcher Ali Sanchez. And they also signed Luis Carpio that year for $300,000. And his career is kind of probably not going to develop into anything, but you never know.
I will always believe.
Somewhere, a bearded man drinking a very complicated cocktail and listening to an obscure album somewhere in Connecticut just like perked up at his desk for reasons we can't explain. Luis Carpio was mentioned in the ether somewhere. Another dude who never came back from a shoulder issue, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he came back quote very unquote, changed.
Yeah.
I'm not looking at the numbers in front of me. I think like he kind of had no power, but he was hitting for a decent average in like 2018. And then last year he just kind of sold out for power and his average just kind of plummeted. So he doesn't know what he is, and I guess neither does the organization.
Still only 23, and he was an above average hitter at AA in 2019, so there's maybe something there, but it's just kind of punchless. Walks a lot, though.
Mm.
Could still be like a benches, and if I recall correctly, those arms a little short for short. So. Yeah.
He's one of those dudes that I like for, I don't really know why.
But why I not? So, yeah, but all in all, over these last couple of years now, the Mets minor league system went from one of the worst in baseball from the late Omar years to being one of the best. Mm-hmm. Going into the 2015 season, which is where we're going to stop here, the strength of the minor league system is probably at its highest, you know, in at the very least the 8 years that I've been doing this. Because here was our top 10 from that year in 2015. Number one prospect, Noah Syndergaard. Number two, Steven Matz. Number three, Brandon Nimmo. Number four, Dilson Herrera. Number six, that's a weird thing. I just copy and pasted and I forgot to put number five.
Kevin Plawecki.
Thank you, Kevin Plawecki. Number six, Rafael Montero. Number seven, Michael Conforto. Number eight, Ahmed Rosario. Number nine, Marcus Molina. And number 10, Gavin Caccini. And then there's some other notables with Dom Smith at 11, Rob Gesellman at 15, Michael Fulmer at 20, Jeff McNeil at 24, and then you also had already in the majors Matt Harvey, Zach Wheeler, Kevin Plawecki, and Travis d'Arnaud. So,
Steve, you schmuck, you ranked Conforto behind Montero and Plawecki. What are you doing?
I don't know. my rule at the time was if I ranked somebody at the same place or relatively close as Jeff, then I did okay. So,
hey, Jeff had Marcus Molina in addition to those two guys ahead of Conforto. So,
that was the summer where I want to say Jason Parks like discovered Molina and that he was like really good. So,
yeah, I remember this.
But yeah, what a high watermark for the minor league system.
That's a hell of a group.
Mm-hmm. And with the exception of Dilson and Marcus Molina, they all made the majors. And of that group, with the exception of, Dilson did make the
majors. Dilson has like 200 play appearances. Yeah.
So basically with the exception of Molina, then they all made it. And then with the exception of Dilson, Molina, and Cheech, they've all had pretty solid runs to some degree or another.
Yeah, absolutely. Claw's a reasonable backup catcher. Matt's might have too many injuries and could be shot now, but had a couple good seasons. Everyone else is between good and great, yeah. Honestly.
Even Travis figured it out. Well, he was good in 2015, and then...
Don't get me started on the Travis rage cut, please.
And now he's real good again. Mm-hmm.
Good. Mm-hmm. I hope he just blasts the Mets out of existence for the rest of time, because they deserve it.
Oh, is he the new Yadier Molina?
I mean, he's certainly more likable.
Yes. Well, so we paused now at the beginning of the 2015 offseason, but you can definitely see how the team is now poised to make that run in the playoffs in 2015. So, any last words of the week?
I like Sandy. I'm looking forward to fun press conferences again.
That is true. He did have some sarcasm that we could all appreciate.
Brody's just like the most boring corporate speak dude ever, and Sandy was like, had that really
a competent
great,
major
yeah.
league
yeah.
executive.
And with like that really great dry wit. There's always, like, you always like chuckle at least once during a Sandy press conference, I feel like.
I'm very curious to see what he looks like with assuming Cohen gives him a big budget, with a big budget to spend.
I would much prefer him. Well, we maybe save this discussion for after we do a couple of these. What the role we'd like to see him in is.
Oh, I think we could all agree that he will be nothing but a net positive going forward.
Yes.
Yep.
All right. If anyone has any questions, comments, whatever, you could send us an email at our email address from complexthequeens@gmail.com. And please, whoever it was out there, do not use our email address to sign up for like porn. I don't want to have any more porn spam, so thank you. And you can follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Sipa. Lucas is at ElVlahos343. Ken is at Ken1191. And Thomas is at SadMetSeasonSZN. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. Rate and review it. And, of course, thank you for listening. And we will be back next week. So until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets. Thank you.